I'm Device from Astralis, and welcome to Foreign's YouTube channel. It's a joke-free zone.
Right, this is going to be another episode of Reflections, and my guest for this one is going to be Peacemaker, who is obviously a long-time Brazilian CSGO coach. So where I actually want to start, Peacemaker, is with most people who are like famous players, etc. I'm quite famous in my interviews. I don't really do that much about like when you start playing CS or like, you know, the first teams, Archer. That's sort of, I find it a bit hackney. Like it's kind of like what I leave to like mainstream people. But in your case, the reason I'm quite interested to actually know about like when your playing career was and what you were doing in the original versions of CS and stuff is because I actually think an interesting part about this conversation is going to be actually Brazil seemed fairly resistant to coaching, and it doesn't really seem like the first place where people would imagine guys would voluntarily become coaches. So I wondered actually, what was your playing career like? How much did you play? How were you on like a semi-pro level? It looks like you were like just almost in like some of the good teams with the big players, but you just missed them, right?
Yeah, correct. And I think I started a long time ago, actually, like back in 2002 or something, when I think it was CS 1.3 or something like that. And when I started, pretty much as just like everyone.
Like you're like 15 years old at the time or something, right?
Yeah,
maybe
something like that. Yeah, exactly. So I was still in school, just going to internet cafes just for fun, you know. And I think I would say that I started like playing competitively, like probably like around 2006 or something. That's when I started like joining a couple teams in Brazil and trying to grind my way all the way to the top. But it was really difficult because like we had no support back then, obviously. Like it was really hard to compete. We're basically doing it just for, you know, the sake of like having a passion for CS. And that's mainly it. Like we had to, you know, pay everything by ourselves, basically. Like there was no support from the organizations and stuff. And I mean, the prize pool from the events was obviously pretty bad. We're competing for like keyboards, mouse pads, and that kind of stuff. So it wasn't necessarily like very professional as it is today. But yeah, like I started and I did compete for a couple teams. I actually met a lot of the professionals and people from the scene back in the days, you know, back when there was a Generation X, like G3X, MIBR, and all those guys. Like that's when I pretty much started following the competitive scene. And at least in the Brazilian scene back then, it was very dominant. Like those two teams were super dominant in Brazil. So it was really hard for the other teams to catch up. And it was just mainly like MIBR and G3X winning pretty much all the events. And there was a couple other good teams as well. But the funny and good part about back in the days was just the LAN environment. I think people had a lot of fun.
Almost everyone played from LAN, right? People weren't playing from home on PC. So everyone was in the LAN cafe, right?
Yeah, everyone in LAN cafes, and also like the practices as well, they were all happening on LAN, right? Like you're booking right with the other teams. There was no WhatsApp or anything like that. It was just like I think it was Mirk or some kind of program, yes, like that. Like we had some kind of a communication, yeah, back in the days. We're just booking the practices, and then the only thing you had, some of the teams had in Brazil, was like you were basically sponsored by the cyber cafe, like the internet cafe. So you were able to either play there for free, so you had like five computers where you had to bring all your stuff, peripherals and all that kind of stuff, or you even had to pay, but a smaller fee than the regular customers, right? So you're basically like booking with the other teams, practicing like four or five maps a day, pretty much as it is today. But it was fun because like you're meeting new people, you're playing against each other on LAN in a completely different environment. So the environment itself, it was really nice. It was really fun to play. But yeah, as you said, you're pretty accurate. Like I would say I was like a semi-pro because I never was able to like play on a top level or even join, you know, Gaules team or Kogus or Fallens and that kind of stuff. I was competing against them. I was always like falling short against them and not playing. Like my teams was like, I don't know, top 15, top 20 in Brazil, around there. And yeah, that's pretty much how I started.
I want to ask about a couple of names before we get into all the stuff about your career specifically, because you, like you say, you came up in this environment when these big names were around. So actually one name you've mentioned there I'd like to discuss is, right, in the modern day, mainly actually for things he did outside of the game, obviously Fallen now is the big name in Brazilian Counter-Strike and is the godfather and all that jazz because he built up the Games Academy and all the teams he was on. But if people don't know, back in the 1.6 days, like the only name was Kogu. That was it. Like even though people like, for example, FNX was known as a talent, and obviously people like Geeko were legendary players, like Kogu was just something else, right? Like this guy, he was considered like the even people outside of Brazil considered him above all the other Brazilian players. Like, who was this guy to you? Who was he to the Saints?
Kogo was an inspiration for all of us, I think. Like, he was, back in the day, even when the scene wasn't as professional as it is right now, Kogo was already like far like ahead of everyone else. Like, he was just very professional, like an example to the scene. I remember, like, a lot of people, it was kind of like you either hated him or you loved him, because that's what I heard from his teammates as well. Like, he was very harsh and very competitive and very, like, you know, like, his teams, like, he was very, just basically very professional. Like, he was taking the game very serious. He was, like, basically, you know, making sure that his teammates was always, like, put on check and, you know, putting up the hours and all that kind of stuff. And when you were annoying like that, when you were a player like that back in the days when people were not earning money and they're not as professional as it is right now, people would see like, oh, this guy's so annoying, like so hard to play with and stuff like that. But, you know, that's just Kogo. Like, Kogo was ahead of everyone else. He wanted to be the best player in the world. And I'm sure he was one of the best players in the world. Like, he was just insane. I think that it, with Kogo, like, yes, I think he's very talented. But it goes above that, in my opinion. Like, he was putting a lot of hours and a lot of dedication into the game in making sure that his team was functioning and he was pushing his players, you know. He wasn't IGL, but he was always like, I always felt like he had some kind of a leadership role in all his teams, you know. And you could tell that by, you know, all the dramas that happened back in the days with Kogo leaving G3X, going to MIBR and stuff like that. And there was so many dramas around it that you could tell that every team that Kogo joins was instantly becoming like the best team in Brazil. It doesn't matter. Like, it was G3X, and then when he left G3X and joined MIBR became the best team. So, you know, he was just like ahead of everyone else. That's the best way I can describe it. And yeah, other than him, like, for him being an opper, I think, yes, super talented. Like, I don't have words to describe like what that guy was able to do on the server. There was also good oppers, Fallen. There was also a guy, super talented guy. I don't know if you heard about him, but his nickname was Ton. He used to play for MIBR.
Yeah, of course. He just didn't get much international play, but yeah, he was a very good player.
Yeah, yeah. Ton is one of those guys that, like, we still hear about him even today. Like,
some people say he was better than Kogo, right?
Yeah, a lot of people say he was better than Kogo. And actually, like, I think it's not to say anything about Fallen, you know, but I think back in the days, I would put, like, Ton and Kogo were probably the best aupers in Brazil, and like Ton haven't proved himself in the international scene. I think that's the main thing. But the guy was super talented. Like, when I watched him playing behind him, because back in the days you had this opportunity, right? Like, it's not like today. Back in the days you could actually watch the guy playing behind him. And there was a ton of people watching behind then.
For sure.
Yes, I watched Kogo and I watched Ton, and Ton was just insane as well. Like, it's just very unfortunate. I heard he had some kind of problems with depression and some personal problems with his life that made him pretty much retire competitively. Like, he hasn't played CSGO at all. But I think that if Ton kept playing and had more international events and stuff like that, he would probably be just as a legend as Kogo is in Brazil, yeah.
So I've heard similar things. Right, another player that you mentioned, and I actually want to know this for totally legit reasons. There's no meme attached. There's no joke. There's a real question. There's reflections, which is obviously Gaules. Because if people don't know, this is another one of these areas where the one thing that does annoy me a bit about modern day fans, Peacemaker, is it's like what you just said there about standing behind people. They act like because they just came along a few years ago. We just came along a few years ago. Like what you just said there about standing behind people. Like, people will tell me what Forrest was like in 1.6. Like, I was stood behind him. Like, the joke is, if you were like after the game, guys, trying to download the POV demo, I watched the POV demo. I was there. I was just right there watching his monitor going, that's fucking insane. So similarly, right, we all knew Gaules has been on the team forever. Like, the joke is he's been around, like, Counter-Strike, like, almost as long as I have, like, the beginning of the 2000s. And I've even done, like, an interview with him from the end of 1.6, and he was a really different person back then. Because, and this is the key thing that I understand that other people don't, Peacemaker, which is when you go on camera, you're never just yourself. You're always aware you're on camera and people are watching you. you and you have a perception of like, how are they seeing me and what do I want to project to them? And it's quite a complicated thing, which is why people who are actors and stuff get lost and kind of become weird or sometimes become like isolated and all these weird stories here. So back in the day, I remember Gowlitz was actually, funnily enough, one of the most like social people in the scene. He was like a really like fucking a very outgoing guy. He was actually one of the easiest people if you were a foreigner to talk to over the Brazilian players. He was actually sort of one of those guys that people don't know. Back in the day, because we didn't have social media and stuff, everyone wasn't friends like they are in CSGO now. It's more like on each big team, you'd have like one or two players you could talk to who you know that guy speaks English and he's like sort of open to it. So you know, like for example, if it was like Fnatic or something, it'd be Khan and then obviously Taz from the Poles and stuff. Gowlitz was that guy, if people don't know, in the Brazilian city. He's the one that you'd go and see and talk. But actually back then, I would have never said he was a guy with like a big ego or all drama. Am I wrong? Was this going on in the Brazilian city? What happened? Like, give me your thoughts, because to me, he's a totally different guy now. Like, the stream personality Gowlitz is a different guy from 1.6 Gowlitz or whatever, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, Gowlitz became a completely different person after he started streaming and pursuing this career he has nowadays. Like, I think that the main thing with Gowlitz was that I think he did build really good teams back in the days. I think one thing that I have to give credit to the guy was just the fact that he was able to make the G3X organization pretty much by himself. With he had a sponsorship from Intel at some point, but that was mainly it, and it wasn't like anything big at all. Like, it was mainly like Gowlitz was always like very proactive in the scene, trying to get sponsors, trying to do tournaments. He had a manager as well, which you know from today as well, which is Apoka. Like, he was managing the G3X team together with Gowlitz back in the days. And both of those guys, they created a lot of tournaments in Brazil. They brought a lot of sponsorships to help the scene back in the days to grow and stuff like that. But Gowlitz, as you say, like, he was like, that's how I see it, right? As being a semi-pro, I wasn't really like interacting with all the like top players back in the day. So I would say it's easier today to get to know those guys and to maybe shake their hands and stuff like that than it was back in the days. Because back in the days, there was I would say most of those players, they had massive egos. It was just like them they were just interacting with each other.
If you're not as good as them, like, don't talk to them, biscuits, like the vibe of the scene back then. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So it was really hard to interact with those guys. But Gowlitz was different. Gowlitz was one of the guys that was always like super chill, super easy to talk with. And basically, I think the fact that he's streaming, he does show a little bit of that personality from back in the days. Now when he's streaming, he's trying to engage the community and do a lot of stuff for the community. I think that is a part of him. But, you know, other than that, like, the competitive Gowlitz is completely different than the streamer Gowlitz, let's put it like that. Like, as you said very well, Gowlitz, when he's streaming, and I think people needs to know that, like, he, as you said, he's streaming, he obviously he's trying to be himself, but like, even when he started streaming, right, I think he had problems with like depression as well and stuff, like personal issues and stuff like that. He was taking like heavy medicine and stuff like that. And you could tell by when he started streaming that he was also a completely different streamer than he is nowadays. Right. So I think he's just being evolving and trying to change the way he does things. But the competitive goal is, one thing is for sure, like, he was able to build really good teams. He was, again, not very strong individually speaking. I would put him like I know this might sound like weird, but like, he was kind of like a Kerrigan back in the days. You know, he was really good at like building the team, the pieces around him, making sure that they feel comfortable role wise and that kind of stuff. And he was basically taking all the shit back days. He was a main support player, as we call right now, even though we didn't use that term back in the days, you know.
Yes. By the way, just before we get into the other stuff, one thing I would like to actually know is, because I've heard all these stories, I've known loads of Brazilian players over the years. All the stories are very similar. It's about like the LAN cafe and the atmosphere back then. And especially because this is the key thing, because actually Brazil didn't get to interact much with the international world. Like, basically, you guys had one of those scenes where it was like, unless you are either MIBR, whoever wins the qualifier for like World Cyber Games and the SWC and stuff, that's the team that gets to go and play the international teams. Other than that, there were very rarely events in Brazil. hotel. Like, that just wasn't a destination, unfortunately. And crucially, it sounds like when people described the scene back then, like, it was like very much like an insular scene. It was just a scene in Brazil, and it was like you're in the LAN cafe playing, and then you play like a qualifier for this tournament or like a league game of people who come from Rio, if you're in Sao Paulo, whichever one of the two you're in. You go between the two. But it sounds like the scene was like super tight knit. Whereas now in the modern day, it must be really surreal for you, dude. Like, this last major must be so weird if you're from the old school to actually see like the scale that it's gone to is crazy, right? Like, now, like, Brazilian, I mean, Counter-Strike in esports in general is worldwide. I mean, obviously, there's been world champions in CSGO. People like Fallen are enormous figures. Gaules himself, again, like I said, just some guy from the community before, some like giant streamer guy. This must be pretty crazy coming from back in the day, right?
Yes, definitely. Like, I think that's the biggest thing. Back in the days, as you said it very well as well, like, it was very tight. Like, we're basically like, the way that happened was we had a ESWC qualifier like every year, which basically you would go to Paris and play internationally. Then sometimes you had a WCG, as you said, something like that. But that was it. Like, we had no other international opportunities. And if you wanted to go international, obviously you had to pay everything. You had to boot camp. Back in the days, people were boot camping at Inferno Line in Sweden, and it was super expensive. Like, we had no support at all. And even if you wanted to compete at a CPL, even like from older days and stuff like that, it was really hard. Like, you had to, like, it wasn't as simple as it is right now to just, you know, basically like go to Europe, play online, try to qualify for an event. Like, you couldn't play these qualifiers. It wasn't that easy. And there wasn't even like these qualifiers. You had to go to a LAN, you had to, you know, qualify, you had a, I don't know, it wasn't that easy. And in Brazil, basically, we had a lot of events, like in your home city. So like in Sao Paulo, for example, you had a lot of events in Sao Paulo, and in cities around Sao Paulo, you would go to different internet cafes and compete as well. And some of those teams, some of those best teams, like MIBR and G3X, when they had, you know, when they had the time to do it, they're all like going to these tournaments as long as there was like a pretty decent prize pool and some of the best teams were competing. The main thing about back in the days was that if MIBR and G3X was playing a tournament, it doesn't matter where in Brazil, then everybody else would try to follow and try to go. That was it. Like, if MIBR was in G3X wasn't playing, then that wasn't a like a tournament that people would see like as a prestigious tournament. Like, why would we bother going there? Like, the best teams are not there. Let's whatever. So that was mainly it in Brazil. And to see where we are right now with the scene, as you said, like it's pretty crazy. Like, I think that, you know, just the fact that we have qualifiers nowadays and we are able to compete internationally and we are able, like, it's growing more and more throughout the years and we are having more opportunities to compete and stuff like that. I think that's the biggest thing. Like, I think, you know, the Brazilian teams, we're still a bit far away from European level of Counter-Strike. I think Brazilian teams should still have more opportunities to compete in Europe and to stay in Europe to actually learn. But just in general, like, I think it's still great that we have these opportunities. Yeah, I'm just happy that we still have these opportunities, and it's growing. We're getting more and more opportunities every year, basically.
For people who don't know, one of the other weird, peculiar things about the Brazilian scene is, a bit like North America, when the CGS era happened, and CGS obviously had Source, not 1.6 as the main game of the thing, basically the whole scene just swapped to CS Source and started following that. Like, yeah. There were some people, like, fully if it was like Gaules and some of the others that stayed behind in like the second or third teams and became the next MIBRs and like went to the tournaments in Europe and whatnot. But basically, people don't know, it was mainly just Europe that stayed 1.6. Obviously, nearly all the Americas went CS Source. Now, famously, right, this spawned what, like, at one point was a controversial thing where Fallen was in Source, and you remember he did that interview with HLTV, where now, like, this sounds like blasphemy to the church of 1.6, where he was like, Source is more tactical. Everyone just lost their minds, like, oh my god, even though half the people, to be fair, lose their minds, they never played Source, like, they were just 1.6 fans. So I don't want to ask about that, but I did want to know, like, what was your time in Source like? Because obviously, if you are a 1.6 fan, like, back then, you just play 1.6, it's just one game, that's it. So Source is a pretty different game. What did you actually like it? Was it good?
Yeah, it was good, and I think that my professional period in Source was way better than in 1.6. Probably also because it was more tactical, and I also started as soon as Source came out. So, you know, and I had the background from 1.6, but it was a completely different game, as you said. And my career in Source was better than in 1.6. And I think that in Brazil, at least, I remember, as you said about Fallen and stuff, when Source came out, I remember that Fallen was still doing the Games Academy thing and trying to teach people how to play Counter-Strike 1.6. And I remember that everybody was like hesitating to switch to Source, and Fallen was the main guy who was hesitating a lot about it. Like, I don't think like the Brazilian scene, like most of the professional players, they believed that Source would become a thing, or CSGO and stuff like that. So they're all like, you know, hesitating. And he was still like trying to teach people how to play Counter-Strike 1.6. And he had a huge community already. Like, and so he was, you know, teaching people how to play 1.6 when Source was coming out. And I think that actually hurt the Brazilian scene a little bit, because most of those professional players, Kogu as an example, right? Like, and more players, they ended up not switching to Source. And I think when you think about like the Source mechanics and CSGO,
oh, it's way more similar.
They are way more similar than 1.6, right? So for some of those players who missed this gap between 1.6 and Go without playing Source, like, I think that's when it kind of fell apart for them. That's why a lot of the players from back in the days, they all retired. They even tried to play CSGO completely, but, you know, it was too much of a difference. And yeah, but we also saw Fallen competing Source and some of the other players. They ended up switching at some point. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that's it.
Right. Obviously, one thing that's quite strange, like I said at the beginning of the interview, is like coach wasn't even a thing back then. If people don't know, the term even was just manager. And it just literally meant the guy who books the flights against the water. That really was the thing back then. So even in CSGO in the early days, obviously you weren't coaching at the beginning. There weren't coaches, like, you were playing for the first few years. That's what I wanted to quickly ask before we go into all the rest of the interview, which is, it was quite a few years you were playing CSGO, but just put it this way, I'll just explain it this way. For teams that don't have a page on Wikipedia, so they're not famous, it's not some big team, it's just some Brazilian squad, I assume. So what was this? Who was Peacemaker at the time? Were you actually trying to still be a pro? Was it like, there's a lot of years here before you become a coach. It looks like Counter-Strike's like your life to some degree, right?
Yeah. Peacemaker back in the days, like in CSGO, I was still trying to play professionally. Like, the thing about CSGO, when I switched, I used to play for that pro gaming TD, Target Down, which used to be Fallen's team in Source, and then switched to CSGO as well. And we also had a lineup there. And in CSGO, when I started, it was pretty much like, I even remember the funny story, because when CSGO came out, there was this project with ZQK, Steel, and Fallen, I think, would later on joined this team and stuff like that. It was mainly like one of the best teams in Brazil. And then I remember it was me and Zeus, the coach from Luminosity and all those guys. Like, we're basically playing a lot of deathmatch back in the days, trying to compete for the last spot in that team. It was really funny because, like, me and Zeus were good friends and we know each other since the 1.6 days. And we wanted to be in this team in Pro Gaming TD. So we're basically like competing against each other, playing a lot of deathmatch and, you know, watching demos and trying to, you know, join and fill this last spot in the Pro Gaming TD roster. And then at the end of the day, Zeus was just better than me. He has also more experience than me, you know, played competitively in 1.6 and stuff like that. Had way more experience than me, so he ended up joining that team, and I kind of missed this opportunity, right? And that's when I kind of found myself in a situation where, you know, back in the days, I had to study. I still had, you know, I was still going to university. I was working outside of CS, so, you know, I had to focus on my life, my personal life. So when CSGO came out, for me, it was like I tried to stay competitive for a little while, but then I just stopped playing. Like, and it was just like back and forth for me. I was, you know, doing something else in my life. And then even when I had my first gig as a coach, I wasn't even playing. Like, I was just following the scene and stuff like that, but I wasn't playing competitively or anything like that. I wasn't in a team or anything like that, yeah.
Right. When you came to join, when people will actually start to know you, basically, you became a coach of Games Academy, which obviously not long afterwards became the Temple Storm team, which later on became Immortals, and people then know I'm talking about Henny and Lucas and all those, and later KNG and people like that came in. But it was originally obviously Bolts and Phelps, and people will know the names now. Right. The key thing to remember if you're a casual fan is Peacemaker obviously joins at the moment Zeus left to go to Luminosity, and then Peacemaker came in behind, and then that's how the whole cycle came along. Right. When you came to this team, as I said earlier, I set this up this way because one thing I want to ask you about actually is part of in your career, obviously sometimes it's been a meme that you've been in so many teams, but part of that is actually a function of the fact that coaching, it's only like sort of just the last couple of years it feels like it's even a real thing, Peacemaker. Like even before that, it's like someone who sometimes gets some input and can sometimes say something to a player or runs a practice. What was it like at the very beginning when you joined this team? Like what did coach entail?
The reason why I had this opportunity even to begin with was mainly because of my relations back in the days, right? As I said, I was a good friend of Zeus. I was also a good friend of Dad, the manager from Luminosity, and he was running the Luminosity roster back in the days. And both of those guys used to play with me in Source and also followed my career pretty much the entire way. And the main thing was that from back in the days, I think people were getting coach gigs mainly because of either you're a friend of someone else or because of like, you know, at least in my opinion, I think the main reason why I was brought to the Games Academy project was because first I knew the guys, that helped a lot, but also because in my past teams, I always had some kind of a leadership personality in those teams. So I wasn't the guy like super strong individually who was pulling up big numbers and stuff, but I was always like kind of, I was either IGLing or I had a leadership personality in the team. Kind of like a Kogu type of guy being really annoying, being really, you know, pushing my players forward to be like, hey, you have to be on time, you have to do this, you have to do that. And then even with Zeus and Dad, for example, like again, another funny story, like back in the days we had this team together and I was that, like, I remember days where they wanted to go out on a Friday night and something like that. And I'm just like, guys, we have practice, like we have this tournament on the weekend. Like, what the fuck are you guys doing? Like, and they're just pulling their internet cables to go out and have a drink and stuff like that. And I was this kind of annoying guy, you know, trying to, you know, make sure that the players stay on check and stuff like that. And I wasn't even IGLing back in the days. But this type of personality from back in the days did help me a little bit, you know, because what they needed back in the days after Zeus left Games Academy was not only a coach, a guy who would, you know, manage those personalities in Games Academy team, but also a guy who would potentially IGL that team. Because I think Zeus had a pretty important role in that team. And he was also like helping, I remember who was a IGLing back in the days, but I do think that he was helping a lot, you know, controlling the way the team was playing. And as soon as he left, they needed a guy they could trust, and they needed a guy with experience as an IGL and with a leadership personality, because, you know, it was five young players who lacked experience. It was only Bailey Boats who had experience in that team, and it was Henny, Lucas, Showtime, and Phelps, right? And I pretty much joined with Phelps. Phelps, back in the days, no experience at all. His first main international opportunity. So, you know, and I think that was mainly it. And then when I just said very well, like, I didn't study to be a coach. And I think most of the coaches nowadays, like, nobody actually studied and read books and stuff like that to be able to be a good coach or anything like that. It was mainly about your experience from back in the days. Obviously, you do need experience to be a good coach, but also like connections, basically it. Yeah.
Right. When you came to this team, let's talk about a couple of the players then. So first things first, I want to ask about the twins, right? Henny and Lucas. Because even though they are identical twins, and for real, like, I actually still can't tell them apart, mate. I know that it's supposed to be like based on tattoos or something, but the joke is, like, even though, like, in American movies, obviously, if you're twins, you just swap players or whatever. The joke is it wouldn't even work for these guys to have, like, the most opposite playing style of all time, which is interesting in itself. So just explain, who are these two guys? Because on the one hand, like, people know Henny from his orping, maybe, but even then, they don't know much about his personality and who he is as a teammate. And obviously Lucas had this period where he was in this team forever, and then he only sort of joined MIBR at the end, didn't he? So who are these two guys and how are they different?
Well, even though they're twins, they are very different personality wise like as you said. I think what the best way that I could describe is that you know, even though they're twins, so they're very connected with each other, right? And way more than people believe it is. And it is hard for people to understand that itself, like it is hard. But I think back in the days as well, like it was just hard for them to be like super professionals. Like even though they had this opportunity, I do remember that I had a couple issues with them in terms of, you know, waking up on time, being on the PC when we have to go over tactical stuff and that kind of stuff. Like they're not very professional in that way, but they were both super talented. Like I think Lucas had a way more has a way more stronger personality than Henny has. And I think one of the reasons probably why Henny had better opportunities and kept playing, you know, had better opportunities to play into, like for Furia and those teams, was mainly because he's a he has a little more like a, you know, how do I say it? Like he doesn't have as a strong personality as Lucas. That's mainly it. Like, you know, he's a very chill guy, easy to go with, like very easy to adapt and put him on the team and stuff like that. He's not a guy that is going to take a crazy amount of space or he's going to, like, you know, create problems within the team and stuff like that. So I think that's the best way to describe. In the other hand, like Lucas has a very strong personality, very strong voice, voices his opinion a lot. And I think that's that's the biggest difference between the both of them. But, you know, back in the days, it was just like, I think we didn't have really big issues with those two, other than just like these small issues about them not being on time and that kind of stuff. But I think they're crucial because, like, they're both very funny guys, you know, and when you have a team like we had back in the days with young players and stuff, like we're all pretty much having our first opportunity to play internationally. So everybody was taking it super serious. So to some extent, having those two guys very funny and entertaining and stuff like that, it kind of helped us a little bit. You know, when we felt the pressure and stuff like that, those two would always like crack a joke or do something weird and stuff like that. And we would all, like, you know, end up laughing and stuff like that. So it was pretty nice back in the days, at least, you know, to be able to have those two to kind of like calm down the nerves and stuff.
With these two players, without, like, as you say in American, like throwing them under the bus, I just want to use them as an example for a second, because I know a lot of people who aren't from Brazil find them to be really confusing in the sense that, like, one, they just keep having to play together so many times in their careers, which seems to, like, what always seems to happen is it seems to mean that Henny has to, like, leave a team that's good and join a worse team to go and play together again. But here's the thing, I sort of do get that peacemaker, because as you say, they're literally identical twins who have, like, in a different relationship. They're not, it's not like just a guy that he knows as friend, like, it's literally his brother. So I sort of do get that in a way, but what I wanted to bring up was this. You touched on it there, is I've heard that these two players actually are a little example of something that actually is quite common in, I don't know if it's just Brazilian esports or maybe it's the Brazilian culture, you can tell me, which is basically, I was told, like, you may be expecting too much if you think that when all these people become like pro and get like a salary, that they're all going to be like the most diligent sports player ever, like all the time. I was told basically, like, because people grew up, especially if they didn't grow up with loads of money and they grew up just dreaming of playing CS. I was told once you get to the pro level, some people do just want to be like the example of Zeus and Dead you were given earlier. Like, they want to be like, I'm good at the game. Like, I'll play like enough to be like good and we'll go to the tournament. But yeah, of course, after that, we'll go to the party. And of course, we're going to have chill out after the tournament and take a bunch of days off and go. I mean, the joke is like, do the Villamix thing and just go off for a week or whatever. Like, I've heard this is actually quite sort of like a common sentiment, because the vibe I get is almost like, this is almost like in American culture back in the day, you know, like it's not cool to be the nerd guy doing all the work. It's cool to be the guy who's like almost the best, but sort of like just fucking doesn't even have to try. Like, yeah, whatever, guys. Like, I'm just cool, you know, I'm just good. Like, is any of this true? Is there some of this to some of the players? Because I feel like when everyone wants everyone to be like Cold Zero in his prime and just be in a server all day long playing, like, you're not going to get that from all these players, right? Some of them maybe the rare ones, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges for me as a coach as well. Especially, like, I would say like this, right? To be fair, when we started the Games Academy project and I met those players, I think we're all like very engaged and very like committed to that. But after, I think it's always like this, like when you start winning and you start having a little bit of success and then you see like, oh, I can actually compete on a good level. Oh, I'm actually really good and stuff. And you start getting famous, you start getting a lot of followers. And then suddenly there comes like the, you know, financial opportunities to earn money with a lot of stuff and streaming and that kind of stuff. That's kind of, for me, like where some of the players, they just lose track of like what they should be doing. Like some of them want to be the best players in the world, such as Code Zero, as you mentioned. Some of them want to just earn money. Some of them want to earn money, have fun, and compete, and having those three at the same time.
It's hard.
I mean, it's hard, right? I mean, it's pretty hard. So, you know, it's that's the biggest challenge for players in general, I think, is to kind of like have a balance in their lives in terms of like how much they want to have fun and how much they actually want to be professionals. But I just said yes. Like, I think, especially with the, without throwing them under the bus or anything, I think that's been one of the biggest challenges for Lucas and Henny, right? I think they were both super talented back in the days. Lucas could have developed a lot more as a player, in my opinion. But I think, I don't know if it's his friendships, I don't know if it's just his mentality or what it is, like that, you know, I think if you compare Henny and Lucas from back in the days in Games Academy to Henny and Lucas from today, you just see like a massive difference of like, not only personality wise, when you see Lucas talking, for example, or you have doing an interview or anything like that, even in the Furia days, you could tell that Henny grew a lot more, like in terms of like the way he sees, like the way he behaves as a professional in the scene, than Lucas did. And I think that's the main reason why Lucas ended up not having as many opportunities as Henny did. But yeah, I mean, as you said, that's the biggest challenge, like just players finding the right balance in their lives, and that's it.
Right, another player from this team I want to ask about is Bolt, because like you say, he was the one who was in one of the Fallen teams. Everyone forgets all those lineups, I noticed, before basically Taco and Zeus came over and FNX. Everyone just acts like those lineups were the same players or they didn't exist. Like, Bolt and Steel and all those guys were in those teams. It's just for some reason they were in them and then they were out and they had to come back later. So Bolt is one of the players where it was always a mystery to me, mate, because when I even watched him, even before that in the Fallen team, he actually looked like he was one of the better players, mate. But I have noticed this. He seems to be the player where, if I look at his career, he gets the chance. What happens is he goes down to the second or third best team, and then he's really good, so he gets his chance to come back to the top team, might be the one with Fallen, whoever it might be. But the problem is, it seems like, this is just an outside read, so you can tell me, it seems like he's the guy where, like, I don't know, like, he gets pressured or something, or so, because somehow his morale seems to just, like, go down when he's in the top team. That's why he goes down to the second or third team again, and then he comes back up. Like, he's that guy who, like, he can't stay in the top. Who is Bolt in this sense? He seems like a really good all-round player, mate. I don't get it.
Yes. Boltz is a very good all-round player, as you said. And I think the biggest challenge for Boltz, at least that's what I heard from back in the days, right? And working with Boltz in Thermostorm, as you said, very dedicated guy, very good to have in a team. Like, you know, mainly a guy that you can just put him anywhere in the map and you tell him whatever role he has to do. He was even IGLing with me back in the days. Like, at some point, he even took over the IGL's role in the team. And in the, we even won a tournament with him IGLing. So I think the thing about Boltz mainly is about, like, you know, him being comfortable in the team and not having anything disturbing him outside of the game. That's one of the things. And I think another thing is also, like, just the team environment. I think as soon as the team environment goes to shit because of whatever reason, then that affects him a lot. That, like, he loses a lot of confidence in himself and on his playstyle. That's one of the things. And also, like, I, from what I heard back in the days when he was in Luminosity and SK and stuff like that, I don't know exactly the reason, but that's what I heard. I heard that he had problems with, like, dedication, which is, with, like, sounded super weird to me, because when I coached him in Templestorm, he was super dedicated. He was watching demos. He was putting a lot of hours. And then at some point in those rosters, those iterations of SK, Luminosity and stuff, what I heard was that, like, he at some point, like, he was not putting up the hours. He was committing a lot of mistakes in the game. And then I think it has to be something to do with, like, you know, again, losing confidence and not feeling comfortable in the team, because I think he's probably one of those guys that as soon as he's put out of his comfortable zone, or he's not feeling comfortable, or he doesn't feel like the team has his back, then I think that's where, you know, some players, they would be like, okay, I'm just going to put up the hours right now. I'm just going to grind and try to prove myself. I think he's probably one of those players that, you know, he just goes downhill. You know, and then he loses it. And then I think that's the reason why he got kicked, I think, twice, right, from Fallen rosters and stuff like that. And even, I have property to speak about Boltz right now, because I coached him in Imperial. And again, Boltz with me in Imperial, very dedicated at the beginning, working a lot. And I think he was doing a pretty decent job towards the beginning. And then something happened now that, you know, his performance just dropped massively. Like, if you compare his performance from when we started in Imperial to today, and to be fair, we were also playing against stronger opponents and stuff like that. But again, it just feels like there's something that happens with Boltz that once he starts losing confidence, then it just goes downhill. He's not really, like, mentally strong to be able to come back. I hope he does, because, like, I always describe Boltz as a guy that, like, I don't think Boltz knows the amount of potential he has. And it's kind of weird to me because, like, he's now, again, a player that's kind of like streaming, and sometimes he wants to be a streamer, sometimes he wants to be a pro. He has a girlfriend, and he wants to focus on, like, his personal life. And sometimes, you know, again, I think with the boats, again, it's another good example of, like, trying to find the right balance in his life. I think maybe it's too much stuff going on at the same time. And it's kind of weird to me because sometimes I had a talk with boats, and boats is kind of like talking about retiring to be a streamer and stuff like that. And it's kind of like, mate, you're so young. Like, you have so much potential to grow and to do stuff like that. How, like, it's fine. I can hear that from Fallen, but not from you. Like, I know you can earn a lot of money by being a streamer and stuff like that, but how come, like, you just want to stream? Like, that's the weird part, right? I don't know how much boats wants to be a professional player. That's mainly it. Like, I don't know if he likes, you know, traveling around and doing all the boring stuff and stuff like that. I don't know how much he actually likes it. I think he likes it right now because he's with Fallen, he's with Fair, he's with people that he likes. But I don't know if, for example, if he leaves Imperial, if he would have the motivation and the you know, to keep playing, basically.
And then obviously I wanted to know about Phelps, right? I would say this. It's funny because in the Brazilian scene, there's a lot of people could have that title, you know, like they say in America, like problem child, like they're difficult to deal with. Like obviously that could be FNX. He's been in and out of teams. He's got the wild personality. It could be like Henny. He sometimes doesn't want to go to the top squad he plays with. It's got to be Phelps, mate. The reason why it's got to be Phelps for this title is because I don't think people know. Like if people only watch top level Counter-Strike and you only look at who wins the tournaments, you might think like, why am I going on about this player who's good for a while, but not like, it's like, mate, if you ever go back this exact era of when you coached this team, you know that term, the eye test? This is the player that checks out on the eye test like a motherfucker. This guy, his aim's just unreal. Like when he's making aggressive moves, I remember watching him being like, dude, this guy's like fucking Olaf Meister or something. Why did no one tell me this player exists? Like he's just off in Brazil somewhere. But the problem is, aside from that one period when he was in SK and they won those tournaments in the summer, and then when he came back to MIBR and they had that one run at the major, like he actually hasn't had that much success in his career. Like his resume should be way better. Like, what? Give me your thoughts on this player. Like, why wasn't this player like? In my opinion, for real, this guy should be up there with like. It should be like Cold Zero, Furf, Fallen, Phelps. Like, these should be the names, dude. Like the greatest CS:GO players ever from Brazil, right?
Yeah, I agree. And like when I started coaching Phelps, I could tell that Phelps always had a strong personality, and he's a very shy guy, introspective and stuff like that. So to be able to get him comfortable, to make him comfortable in the team and to get him to talk and stuff like that, it does require a lot of skills, you know. Like you need to be able to, you know, first become his friend and get his trust for him to basically open up with you. And I think that's probably, from what I heard and from what I experienced with Phelps, the main issue with Phelps is just about his personality, you know. I think that what I heard from SK days and coaching and me coaching him as well, it's just like he's super shy, he's very like on his own zone doing his own thing, and he wasn't really a guy that, you know, was having fun and stuff like that. He wanted to, you know, basically most of the time just be by himself and, you know, talk to his girlfriend, talk to his mom and stuff like that. He was very, I think Phelps, it was very hard for me. And like I have to say this, like I did have issues with Phelps back in the days because, like, you know, Phelps was, as you said, like super talented and stuff like that, but it was hard for me to get through him and talk to him and stuff like that because he was very introspective. So back in the days when I didn't have experience, it was hard for me to understand why he was like that. But nowadays I understand it completely, and I found out after, you know, some time. And the thing with Phelps is that he's very attached to his family. Like for a young Brazilian player as him, to be outside of Brazil, away from his family, away from his mother, away from, you know, his girlfriend and stuff like that, it took a massive toll on him. Like, you know, he can stay mentally focused for a period of time, and then after some time, it's just gone. Like, he starts getting, you know, very, I don't know if the word is depressed, but like he started getting sad, basically. Like, and he misses his family, he wants to go back to Brazil, or he wants to bring them to be with him. And I think it's kind of weird because, like, back in the days, all I was about was, like, you know, being professional. I want to be the best team in the world and stuff like that. And then for me, back in the days, I had so much motivation that it was hard for me, even though I should have this understanding, right, that, you know, people are different from each other. But it was hard for me because I could see this guy, like, he was all about, like, his family and stuff. And I was all about, like, I want to be the best team in the world. Like, come on, mate, let's do it together and stuff. Nowadays, I understand, you know, there's different personalities, different people. And I think he's one of those guys that, unfortunately, this is probably like the biggest issue he had throughout his career was the fact that, you know, being away from home is not a thing for him. Like, he always struggled about it. And if it wasn't for that, plus the fact that he's very introspective, I think, as you said, he would be probably like just as good as Coldzera. And he is. That's the thing. Like, Phelps still is a really good player. And when he joins the teams, and if he had an opportunity in Imperial, for example, or Furia, or whatever, he will be there. He will put up the numbers. Like, he is super talented. The thing is, like, how to manage him to stay on the team for longer than a year or something like that. That's the biggest challenge.
Yes. So, okay, when you were in this team, I mean, the funny thing is, I know later people think of them as immortals, and this time we're talking about Games Academy. But technically, they were Temple Storm in the period I'm talking about now. Right? Famously, people don't know the story. What happened was the first big moment, because obviously initially people only knew the squad from the players going to Luminosity. The first big moment was obviously qualifying for Katowice, right? Because that was the one where you won the whole qualifier. It looked awesome, by the way, online. And so then people were like, I remember famously, this is when people were like, wait a minute, there's two good teams in Brazil. Because obviously we just knew the Luminosity team got good. But like, now there's two good teams. But famously, this is a detail people forget, before you could go to Katowice, there was the qualifier for the major, and the major qualifier went really badly, right? Like, that was the one where you were supposed to get through and you lost like flip side or something. So this must have been a big shock, right? Because that the vibe I got there, dude, was it's a bit like we just went through with the online era. Like, when you're only playing online, you get to the same level as the other people, but the problem is when you go to the LANs, it takes a while to get good, right? You have to sort of get settled playing LANs and pressure on. This must have been a big blow to not qualify for the major, right?
Yes, that was a big blow, but also like a very good experience for us because we learned a lot from that. I generally, like, I don't think that we would have done such a good run in Katowice if it wasn't for the major qualifier, even though we bumped out. But I think, as you said it perfectly, like, I think we lacked experience competing on LAN. I think that was like a big, you know, that we definitely felt the pressure. Like, I could tell that, you know, we were a strong team. Everybody was putting up like as one of the teams that should go through back in the days because of our online performances and stuff. But, you know, just the fact that you're playing from home, very comfortable, and you have no pressure and stuff like that, then your first big event is already a major qualifier competing against, you know, teams that you haven't had much experience competing against. Back in the days, we didn't go to Europe and had any kind of boot camps or anything prior to that. So it was just basically us playing in North America, competing against North American teams, some Brazilian teams and stuff. And then boom, you go straight playing against Flipside, very tactical and very slow pace CS and stuff like that. We definitely struggled a lot. But I think that helped us a lot, you know, because after that event, we talked a lot about like the way we prepare for the games, the way we should stay mentally focused for the games, and mainly about preparation for games. I think that was a big turning point for us, because back in the days I was IGLing, and I think we had way too much structure back in the days, and we tried to play against Flipside in a way that obviously didn't work out. Like, we struggled a lot against that passive style, and just the fact that we were able to take that loss and learn from it, I think that helped us a lot in Katowice.
When you did go to Katowice, though, it's funny that you had this like heartbreak at the major qualifier, because when you did go to Katowice, it almost seemed like it was like the dream that you must have thought when you're online and you won the qualifier. Because in this tournament, like, it was where, people don't know, these groups were mega stacked back then. This wasn't like the days when bad teams qualify. Like, all the best teams in the world are at these tournaments. And when you look at this group you guys are in, you're beating like Virtus Pro, like Envy's the major champions, and people don't know. Like, these are like the best teams in the world, like, and making the quarters. And quite frankly, by the way, similar to what I said before about like the level, like that match that you guys had against Na'Vi in the quarterfinals, like, if you guys actually had experience, you would just win this match. This was like a classic example everyone knows, where like the up and coming team, like the favorite just holds on. If you just sort of wait long enough in a match, I always say like the experience eventually just wins, you know. Like, that's why if you're the underdog, you got to beat the team to do that. I mean, fucking whatever, FaZe almost found this out yesterday. You got to just beat him 2-0, haven't you? You got to just get him out the server as soon as possible. So give me your thoughts on this. This must have been like a fucking surreal experience, this event.
Yeah, it was surreal, and I think that, yes, I think the best of one format throughout the group stage kind of helped a little bit, competing against those teams, and we're always able to, you know, end up playing one of our comfortable maps. I think we were very good on Cabo back in the days, and some of those teams even allowed us to play Cabo. I think NBS is a good example, right? We ended up playing Cabo against them. I think that helped, because not only we felt really comfortable, but it also helped us to, you know, get confidence going in the tournament. I think all the players were very good individually. Like, we were hitting our peak in terms of performance. And not only that, but I think the major qualifier experience also helped a lot in terms of adapting mid-game and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, as you said, very accurate. Like, when we went to the series against Na'Vi, it was really a dream coming true, right? Being on stage and all the atmosphere, like, it was crazy. Like, again, that was a little bit different, you know? Like, I didn't feel like the pressure got to us or anything like that in that specific event. Even though we're playing on stage, I think we were just, like, extremely happy. And we were just wanted to prove ourselves, basically. Like, and we got so much confidence after the group stage that I didn't really feel like anyone was nervous or anything like that. The biggest issue, as you said, was just lacking experience, like, on the server. Like, you know, we were playing again against a team very strong on Na'Vi, very methodical CS back in the days, like, super hard to play against. And it just gave all of us flashbacks from the Flipside game. But we did show in that specific game, even on the Mirage, which was the third map, we're up 10-5, if I'm not mistaken. And then I also remember that, I don't remember if we won the pistol or something like that, but we just had a massive lead. And then the biggest thing for us back in the day was, like, you know, once something went wrong in the game, I think we're not strong and good enough to be able to mentally reset. I think that was the biggest challenge. Because I remember in this specific game, I think we lost an eco or something like that, which we should have won. And that took a massive toll on us. Like, I tried taking a lot of timeouts and trying to hype up the boys and try to tell them to stay calm and stuff like that. And then Na'Vi started to build momentum. And Na'Vi building momentum back in the days, it was just, like, too much for us. And then we ended up losing a game. I think it was 16-40, 16-13 or something like that. But again, as you said, if we had more experience, if we didn't collapse under the, you know, the pressure we felt on that third map specifically, when we basically could feel like, oh, we're actually doing this. We're beating Na'Vi. Like, we're going to make it to the finals or something like that. Like, come on. And then once that, you know, things started going wrong, yeah, then that's actually when we felt pressure and we were not able to adapt, unfortunately.
Another tournament that we'll talk about, and then we'll skip to some of the other teams, is obviously, as you said, you won a tournament in this team. You won the C4 tournament that was hosted by Gfinity in the UK. Right. What's funny is when people look at this tournament, like, if they see you played like Pimps SK Gaming in the final, they're going to be like, who cares? It's like, these guys had to beat Virtus Pro in a best of five in the semifinals. Like, yeah. And even though people are going to say, like, that was when Virtus Pro was in one of their slumps, like, you have to remember a Virtus Pro slump is like they just come quarterfinals and lose to the best team in the world. But, like, they were definitely not a bad team at all. So, like, this actually was it's actually an underrated run, in my opinion. Like, some of these teams you've beaten are good. Like, and also as well, like, just winning in itself is like a meaningful experience, right? You don't have to beat the best team in the world. Like, it's still hard to win on stage and win in a tournament and be the guy who lifts the trophy, right? What was the significance of this win for you guys?
I think it meant a lot. And also, like, for this event, I have to give credit to Boats because, you know, after Katowice and some more events that we had, like online qualifiers and stuff like that, I think that, you know, we started to kind of, like, obviously when you make it to closer to the top and you start competing against stronger teams and stuff like that, and once you start losing, because we did have some kind of a honeymoon period at some point where we're winning everything and then Katowice comes and blah, 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 and then it's all great. But once you start losing and start, you know, having issues and stuff like that, that's where, you know, Boats stepped up a lot and he wanted to IGL. He wanted to just let me focus on coaching and preparing for the games. And he wanted to try some kind of a different environment for the next events. And that was actually hard for me back in the days because, like, I really wanted to, like, you know, try to adapt to the way they wanted to play and the way they wanted to do things. But instead, but I did understand back in the days that it would be hard for me to switch the mode, like, from the way I see Counter-Strike to the way that Boats wanted to call. So I just found out, yeah, you know, whatever, like, just you can just be the caller. I'm just going to prepare for the games and try to help you with timeouts and stuff like that and opinions mid-game. Because back in the days, you were able to talk, you know, and it was a completely different environment. But Boats was actually IGLing in that tournament. And we had a lot of changes in terms of, like, the play style and stuff like that. So I think I have to give a lot of credit to Boats. And I think he did a good job on, like, managing the team and making sure that the people felt happy while playing and felt comfortable while playing, because sometimes under my system, I was very, like, methodical and I wanted things to be done exactly the way I wanted and stuff like that. So it was a bit annoying to some extent. So I think Boats did give the players another big reason for them to perform well in that specific event. And as I said, like, even though we beat the likes of SK and VP, Virtus Pro and stuff like that, VP back in the days was very, very hard. And as you said, like, I think it was a best of five, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. I mean, it was our first big international win, right? Like, not big, but, like, for us back in the days, it was huge.
Sure.
And, yeah, that's when I think that after we won that event, again, that's when, you know, we kind of started to, like, kind of overthink a little bit of the stuff. And then after we won that event and we did great in Katowice, that's where, you know, personalities starts to, you know, shine a little bit, and then egos and then stuff like that. And then, yeah, after that, I guess we kind of fell apart a little bit. Like, we started to, you know, relax way too much when we actually should have taken that opportunity to, you know, grind even more and actually stabilize as a top team.
Right. When you then came and joined Team Liquid as their coach, I want to ask this initially, right? If people don't know, the timing of when you joined was after they'd already had the run at Columbus where Adren came back to be the stand-in, then they'd had the bombed out at Malmö. And so the team you inherited was already one that was going to have problems. Because if people don't know, your first event was fucking E-League, which if people remember, what's the only moment of Team Liquid everyone remembers from E-League is more clowning on Kooster, fucking up the Molotov or whatever. Like, and obviously that event went really badly and people know Kooster was barely in this team for very long, because part of the problem was, and luckily I was friends with Hiko and some of the players, so I know some of the backstory on this. Basically, the premise was when they decided to move on from Adren, they kind of almost just did it, unfortunately. Like, back in the day, people used to recruit. You don't actually think, what player do we need or what spot? They were just like, who's the best player available? So they were like, right, that Kooster guy in NME's really good. And what they ignored was, we've got fucking Simple, who's the AWPer. Like, so they brought him in, and obviously there was all issues, and Simple sort of like didn't accept him as an AWPer, and he took it off him, and then eventually just got booted out very quickly, right? It sounds like if you're going to join a team, you want to join a team that's like set, and it's like, right, now I can start having my impact. This sounds like a real mess, mate. And then obviously the other thing that you alluded to earlier was, because they've kicked Adren out, now they don't have a proper IGL. Now they were like taking turns of different people doing it. So eventually, right, when you joined, was it already the idea that you would essentially, like, I know it's not technically in game leading because you're not in the server, but was it at the time, obviously I know later you became the guy who was just calling from the coach position. Was it already, was that part of why you got the offer for Team Liquid, and what was this initial squad like? Looks like a fucking mess to walk into, mate.
No, it was a mess, and I think that yes, when I joined, I remember that having talks with Hiko specifically, and I think they already had in plan to remove Adren and Kusta from the roster and go to the major and the other qualif tournament. I think it was a Faceit event, ECS event or something like that. I think they already had in mind to get rid of those players, but, you know, I don't know if it was a roster lock with E-League or anything like that, but I remember when I joined as a coach, it was already pretty much set that those two would be gone, and they wanted me to be the IGL from the team, and they wanted to bring some... They wanted to make a team, basically, back in the days, you could abuse that. So they just wanted to make a team where all five players would just basically focus on shooting people and doing their roles the best way they could, with me calling from behind. That was mainly it, yeah. But I remember that when I joined, even though it was a mess, I took that as a massive opportunity for me, because, like, I really wanted to try to IGL in English. Back in the days, even though I did speak English in a pretty decent, I would say, but I wanted to challenge myself and be in a different, completely different environment and stuff. And I think when I started coaching Games Academy, I was also able to, like, hang out with some of the Liquid guys in events or get to chat with him online. So I was a good friend of Elijah as well. So it was just like a good opportunity, because I really knew some of them. I was good friends of them, and they could see, like, the amount of, you know, the amount of development that I was able to do together with the boys in Games Academy. So I mean, they had a lot of trust in me as a coach and IGL, and that helped a lot. That helped a lot, because as soon as I joined Liquid, even though they were having massive issues with the roster, underwhelming performances and stuff like that, and yes, later on Simple came and helped and blah, 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 but I think the fact that they gave me a lot of trust to build my own system the way I wanted and stuff, I think that helped a lot.
Right, obviously people know now we're going to tell the story of the fucking famous Simple Team Liquid ESL Cologne, right? That amazing run to the final, etc. But I've got to set it up, because I feel like people miss these details. Like, first of all, for people who forget, Simple had actually been out of the team already. He was just a stand-in for this era. Like, what happened was, after that Malmö period, it wasn't just that he had issues with Kooster. He also basically just said, like, I want to live in Ukraine. I don't want to live in America anymore. And he left the team. He went back to Ukraine. And he wasn't even playing for anyone good, if people don't know. He was in a, like, a mixed called Worst Players, which was literally just him and his friends from the Ukrainian scene. And at the time, by the way, he was still fucking insane. Like, I remember watching him at like a Star Ladder or something where he was just carrying against everyone. So then he came back because he was friends with Hiko and there needed to be a stand-in for Team Liquid. But the detail everyone forgets Peacemaker is, as you said, there's an ECS before this major. And at the ECS, the team did nothing. It just went there. It was like, whatever. It might even come last place. Like, it was just irrelevant. And because he was just technically the stand-in, this is the key detail to make. No one had any expectations, even within the team, from what I remember from like Hiko and that. Dude, they had no expectations. The premise just was like, look, we needed a stand-in. He is like the best possible stand-in. Like, let's just sort of hope, you know, like, let's just hope it goes well. And so I remember, famously, people always, this is one detail I noticed fans always like delete from their memory. Everyone thinks I'm mega biased, right? Well, everyone knows I love Simple. I was friends with Hiko. You can go and watch this major, dude. I predicted against you every single match. Like, I'm not even joking. You guys weren't even supposed to get out of that group. That group was fucking stacked. They had like Nico Mouse, yeah. Sports, like, that was a banging group. Had like Envy or something. Not only are we not supposed to get out of the groups, there's no way you're supposed to beat Na'Vi. Na'Vi's one of the best teams in the world. And then Fnatic, forget about it, mate. That was like all the legendary players, world majors. Like, this is one of the craziest runs I've ever seen, dude. Like, I remember watching it and just being like, is this real life? Like, what's going on here? It's why, if people don't know, I mean, this is actually part of what sort of let me look like a genius now by saying Simple was going to be like the greatest player ever. Because I remember just watching that tournament and be like, if this guy doesn't become the best ever, then what's the point? Look at the eye test. It's unbelievable. So, the reason I set it up like that, Peacemaker, is give me some of the background on this. Like, what happens? You bring in a guy who's a stand-in who's like, you know, he's not going to be there permanently as well. He's just coming in for these two tournaments. Like, how does this miracle run come out of this? What happened? What allowed this to happen?
I think it was funny because, like, when we brought Simple to the team, I think it was very clear for all of us, as you said, that he wouldn't be permanent. But I remember that Hiko used to be very connected with Simple. So when I talked with Hiko a few times, Hiko was always like, oh, mate, if we're able to win the major or do great at the major, maybe I can get Simple to stay, right. You know, convince him, yes, to stay and stuff like that. So I was like, yeah, I mean, that would be pretty good for us. But and then, you know, always there was also like this personality clashes between Simple and some of the players, I think Elige and stuff like that, like they didn't get along very well. So it was challenging to manage those personalities. But, you know, when we brought Simple to the team, as you said, we had no real big expectations or anything like that. One thing that helped a lot, again, the loss at the ECS did help us a lot in terms of like the way we would prepare for the major. It gave us a lot of like, it gave us an opportunity to try a couple different things during that event that we would maybe try at the major, and we actually switched some of the stuff because of the loss in that tournament. But one thing that helped us a lot, and I don't know exactly why or how it happened, but we had a boot camp in prior to ECS. We had like, I don't know, a 12 days boot camp or 10 days boot camp or something like that with Simple. And we were basically like playing a lot of hours. Like, I mean, it was 10 to 12 hours a day of Counter-Strike or something like that. And after we're done with that boot camp, like, I promise you, like, I never had a boot camp with so much success as we had in that one. Like, we're just basically shutting down everyone. We're winning against every single team. And after the boot camp was over, we're just like, I don't know, like, is this like, if we're able to pull these performances on at the major, then that's it. Like, we're going to win against everyone. So we're super, super confident after the boot camp. And in that boot camp as well, it wasn't like a fairy tales or anything like that. We had a lot of issues, like, especially, you know, with personalities and stuff like that. Like, I remember Simple, for example, he was a completely different personality as he is right now, right? And Simple was super dedicated, even as a standing like that. I got to give credit to the guy. Like, he was probably like first guy waking up, last guy going out of the room every single day. But he was crazy. Like, he was like, you know, it was hard to keep up because, like, he wanted, even though he was standing, he wanted to prove himself so much that it was hard for the others to follow up. And it was even harder for me to, like, understand, like, what was happening, basically. And the biggest challenge with Simple was that since he wasn't a part of, like, the team, like, on a permanent basis, it's not like he was doing stuff for the team and stuff like that. I remember a lot of the times we're going over tactics and the way we wanted to play and stuff like that. And it was just like, whatever, dude, I'm just going to do my own thing. Like, I don't care about what you guys are saying. I want to play my own game. So there was actually a lot of maps and a lot of tactics that we had back in the days. It was just like four guys very aligned on the same page about what we're doing. And then Simple had freedom to do whatever the hell he wants to do. Just because, like, that way, we would make him comfortable, and we would be aligned, and we would feel comfortable that way as well as a team. So I think it would be a completely different story if we try to, you know, push Simple and be like, hey, Simple, like, you're standing, you have to be with us, you have to go over tactics, you have to do stuff. If we pushed him to do all those things, I think he wouldn't have the performance he had at the major. And also in the same way, like, if we would be like, oh, this guy doesn't want to be a part of the tactics, don't want to be like a part of the whole thing, let's just give up and just do whatever at the major and stuff, then it would also be a tragic run, right? So I think we were just really good at, like, understanding Simple and making sure that everyone else was aligned, and we felt comfortable that way. And yeah, I think, yes, Simple performance at the major helped a lot. As you said, like, I think having competed against, as you said, MVS, right? And me, I had a little bit of a background competing against MVS because of the Temple Storm days, so I had a good understanding of how to call against them. Mousepads with Nico, I think that was a very underwhelming performance. To be honest, like, I remembered a little bit of that game, and I remember that for some reason Nico wasn't playing good. Like, to be fair, I think Nico was already a superstar back in the day, like, super talented, and I don't think he had a good game. Maybe if he actually had a good game in that series, it would be a different story. I think he just had an off day, like, they were just not playing as good as they should. That helped us a little bit. And then, yeah, going against Na'Vi and Fnatic and stuff like that, I think, once again, I think we had a really good understanding on how to compete against those teams. Also because we have practiced against those teams a lot in the bootcamp. And again, we just gained so much confidence and understanding of, like, which way we should call and play against each one of those styles. Because back in the days, you could, like, the Fnatic way of playing was completely different than the way Na'Vi used to play, right? And we just had a really, really good understanding of how we should play against that specific way of Counter-Strike. Yeah, that was mainly it.
You said there, like, essentially use, like, the classic style of, like, you just let Simple do whatever he wants, that we'll sort of, like, play real Counter-Strike over here, right? Give me a sense of, like, when you have Simple on your team, is he, like, what's his vision of how he's going to play the game?
I think for Simple, it's like this. He's, it's hard to describe it because, like, he has a very good feeling of the game. And I even said it in the broadcast during the major that Simple for me is one of those players that he feels the game a lot. And if you play scared against him, if he feels like he has space to do whatever the fuck he wants to do and have space to do all his peaks and feel comfortable in the game, that's when Simple just pops off. And it has been like this ever since I met him, when I coached him. And yes, he has developed a lot and has been the best player in the world, like, in my opinion, and has proven himself. But I think the main thing about Simple is that he's super dedicated. Like, again, people just see Simple as, like, as a super talented player, like, gifted or whatever. Like, oh my God, this guy's insane. But Simple does put a lot of hours into the game, a lot of hours. And he did dedicate himself a lot to the game back in the days to be able to be where he is right now. And I think that helped a lot. And the biggest challenge for Simple from back in the days to today was mainly, I think the biggest challenge for him was, again, his personality, being away from family, just like Phelps, for example. You know, it was hard for him to be out of Ukraine, away from his family and stuff. And I think he was able to, over time, understand what was needed and found the right balance in his life. And that helped me to, that helped him to find balance in Counter-Strike as well. Like, nowadays, he's super consistent. But it's just hard. Like, the way Simple sees the game is that, like, I don't know nowadays. I think he actually has changed a lot. But back in the days, like, he already knew, in my opinion, he already knew that he was ahead of a lot of the players. So he just wanted, he knew that he had the potential to carry Liquid, to carry over the team. And he was just a lot better than a lot of those players individually. So I think it was right. It was a good choice for him to have that personality to be like, you know, I wanna do my own thing because I am able to shut down those players, you know, because I'm just way better individually than them. And I think he proved that. And if he didn't have that strong personality, and maybe he wouldn't be the player as he is right now, you know.
In this year, 2016, one thing we saw, to touch on something you said earlier, was when you were in Temple Storm, that team was famously very good on Cobblestone. Then he came to Team Liquid. This team was really good on Cobblestone. Then even when Simple left, famously the whole reason that ESL New York run happened was fucking winning on Cobblestone against everyone. What is it about Peacemaker and Cobblestone? What do you like about this map?
I think I learned a lot with the Brazilian guys, to be honest. Like, it wasn't a Peacemakers, Cobblestone, or anything like that. But I think, like, the map itself, back in the days at least, it was It was a map that, yes, you could do a lot of strategies. You could do a lot of stuff, strategically speaking, like a lot of walls, most towards B. You could run fakes and stuff like that. And I was really good at that back in the days. But also, like, it wasn't a map where you could switch up the pace and rush and do rushes and fast pace, yes, which was something that I didn't like back in the days. Like, my teams used to be teams that we either had a lot of, like, methodical stuff, like slow pace style, letting the players work on getting, you know, developing map control, or like a lot of like fakes and stuff like that. So I think that's one of the main reasons why we were able to play good on Cobble, because it's just like the map is so huge. There's not like a map where you can play fast pace CS and just rush everywhere. I think that's mainly it.
Right. What a player, if people don't remember this, the timeline went like this. Even though, like, technically, they'd actually already, behind the scenes, like, signed Pimp before Simple came to stand-in again. But obviously, like, Simple had to play the stand-in events. And then after that, Pimp came in to replace him. But at the time, obviously, like, you rechanged all the roles. Like, Pimp basically was, like, the support player or something, right? So, like, as you said, the vision at the time was, like, if Peacemaker's, like, the coach IGL, everyone else can just be players, right? I remember when this move happened, like, some people blamed Pimp, and obviously he wasn't a star player like he was many years back in the day in Denmark. How would you say this lineup of Team Liquid was? Because it was obviously a very different type of team. Like, it had a lot of elements, right? Like, on the one hand, Hiko's maybe coming off his boil and not getting as good at the game anymore. Like, Nitro's good, but like maybe hasn't broken through. Like, your Liege starts to get good. It's a team again. Like, I would say it's like, in English you said, in flocks. Like, everything's changing, everything's moving, right? So what was this era of Team Liquid like when you got the Pimp lineup in?
It was a bit weird, because like, I don't remember exactly the main reasons, but I remember that Simple wasn't like our main option back in the days for the team. I think we tried a couple of different players as well, but I don't know if it was financially or like because of contracts and stuff. It was just hard to get the players we wanted, but Pimp was one of the options, right? And I remember that, like, you know, we also brought JD. No, JDM was already in the roster, right? Yeah. So when we brought Pimp, obviously, like, when you go from Simple to Pimp, it's a massive difference in the team, right? And it was a little bit weird, because, like, after we had such a good run in Cologne, I remember that, you know, this is some inside story, right? But I remember that, again, remember when I said that maybe we could have kept Simple in the team? I remember that during Cologne, he was already hanging out a little bit with the Navi guys and stuff like that. But I remember talking to Hiko a couple of times, and Hiko was like, dude, I think if I, you know, we just made it to the finals of the major, maybe if I talk to Simple, we could get him to stay in the team and stuff like that. And then I remember that, I don't remember exactly why, but I think Elish didn't want him in the team. Like, the environment itself, it wasn't healthy, you know, like, it wasn't healthy. So I understood the reason why we didn't even try to go that route and try to keep Simple in the team. But that, after that run, I think the team kind of felt like a little bit weird. I think Hiko wasn't happy about the fact that we didn't even try to keep Simple on the roster. And then suddenly we're playing with Pimp. I think it was a very weird period. I think Pimp did try his best and during that period, but it was just like too much for him. But I think one of the biggest issues we had with that iteration of the roster was, I think, to be fair, like, me and Pimp didn't get along very well. Mainly because, like, the way I saw the game, the way I wanted to do things was completely different than the way Pimp saw the game and wanted to play. And once he joined the team, he tried to follow my way of playing for a short period of time. And then he started to, like, you know, try to bring his experience from Europe and the way he saw things and stuff like that. And then that brought us to a scenario where the team didn't know who they should believe or who they should follow, if they should try the Pimp style, if they should try mine. And obviously, we had such a good run at Cologne, and then we lose Simple, and then obviously the performances would drop a little bit. And again, in my opinion, at least, we did have issues after the Cologne run with, like, you know, people kind of losing focus a little bit, you know, we just made it to the major final, let's just chill a little bit here, like, let's just slow down a little bit, we're playing way too much, let's just go home, get a couple of days off, and then come back, and then let's just do 2 or 3 maps a day instead of 5 maps as we used to do. So once you slow down like that, and then you relax, and then you bring a new player, where instead of relaxing, you should be, you unfortunately, you have to put up the hours to be able to make that guy feel comfortable and you to feel comfortable as a team. We did actually the exact the opposite of that. And then that's when problems started. We started losing matches. We started losing confidence. And then, yeah, I wasn't really great as well as a coach. an IGL to be able to, you know, calm down the scene and be like, hey guys, this is my way of calling, like, calm down, like, it's a process, we just started with a new roster and stuff like that. So for me, back in the days, I was a little bit harsh, you know, because at some point people are questioning my calls and stuff, and I'm just like, guys, we just made it to the major final, I was calling, like, come on, let's believe me. And I wasn't good, and I wasn't as good as I am right now today as a coach to be able to explain them about the process and stuff like that. So for me, back in the days, it was just like my way or the hard way kind of thing. And then that's where I kind of lost, I lost a little bit of the respect from the team, and I had issues with Pimp. And then the team, as I told you, like, the team is kind of like in between, like, what do we do now? The team is completely lost. And then I think Pimp had a really good understanding of, like, the way he wanted to try things. He didn't want to IGL, but he wanted me to change the way I saw the game and change the way I was doing things back in the days, and it was too much for me. So it didn't work out, like, and then we kind of, you know, we were underwhelming, we had underwhelming performances back in the days because of it.
This actually brings up a topic that obviously I wanted to talk about in this interview, which is part of the reason that you as a coach for a while became like a fucking meme. And the premise was like Peacemaker just joins a new team every month, which is exaggeration. But at the same time, as you'll see in a minute, like there were some teams you were in for a couple of months. That's true. And there was one where it was like a month, but that's the extreme version. Part of the reason this became a meme, which I want to get to, was again, it's like why I say that coaching wasn't really a thing as much back then. It was like still being introduced as a concept even. And even when you do it as a job, like you're saying, it's like as you're doing the first jobs, not every player even maybe buys into the concept. And in fact, that term buying in is what I want to discuss here, because I've noticed as a coach, it feels like you had a similar problem I've known some IGLs to have, which is some IGLs, I always say, like, that's why the leader part of the name can be tricky. Some IGLs are just brilliant tacticians. Like, they can call a great strat, they can design a great strat, they could tell every player what to do, but they might not be a great leader. Like, they might not be able to get the player to buy into it. They might not be able to convince him. Like you say, sometimes you know you're right, but it's hard to know how to communicate with this player and to even explain to him that, like, look, even though you don't think what I'm going to do is good, it's actually even going to be better for you, mate. Like, if you can understand, like, what I'm trying to get you to, we're all going to be better. Like, it sounds like this is something that's been part of your challenge in your career, right?
Yes, right. And I think that's one of the biggest issues even nowadays for a lot of the IGLs. As you said, very accurate. Like, I think in order to be a good IGL, you need to be a good leader, and you have to understand how to manage personalities and to get them to do what you want. That's the biggest challenge as an IGL, because, like, nowadays, especially nowadays, you have so many tools to be able to, you know, grind in the game and know a lot of tactics, a lot of stuff about the game and stuff. But if you don't know how to communicate well and manage personalities and stuff, it doesn't matter. Like, it really doesn't matter how much knowledge you have if you don't know how to share that with your teammates. And yes, I think that was probably one of the biggest challenges I had in my career, especially at the beginning. And again, just like, and that's the main reason why I use this example for the players, is that I think I went from being an unknown coach with no experience at all to suddenly in 1 year competing at the major final and qualifying for a lot of events. I think that did take a little bit of a, you know, about my ego, you know, because, like, I had so much success calling and stuff like that, and my system was working in Liquid and Tempo Storm, that, like, when people started to question the way I saw the game or the way I wanted to do things just because of one or two bad runs in events, I think that was a little bit too much for me, you know. Like, and back in the days, I wasn't really, like, a good leader. And again, like, I didn't know how to manage some of the personalities. So as soon as I started getting challenged, it was too hard for me to, you know, stay mentally focused to just be like, guys, like, this is happening because of this. Like, we're going through a process. We need to do this and that. Like, it was, for me, it was just more like, dude, why are you even questioning me? Like, we just made it to the final of this. We just did this and stuff like that. Just shut up and let's keep practicing and stuff. So I think it wasn't healthy at all. Like, I think that period took a toll on my career, and that's the main reason why I fell down after Liquid and started, like, having, as you said, like, a lot of a period where I'm coaching teams for, like, a month or two or 6 months or whatever and struggling a lot. That was because, like, I was trying to reinvent myself as a coach. Also because I think it was actually in the Pimp iteration where Valve came with the new rule where coaches were not able coaches were not able to talk anymore during the games. And when I saw that as well, that also took a massive toll on me, because going from a guy who was already being questioned in that roster. And then when the Valve news came, it was even harder for me to like, oh, now it's not even a choice for me anymore. Like, I have to give up on my IGL thing. Like, it's not a thing. I cannot, it's not like I can write on a piece of paper like, hey, you guys should do this, 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 and just give it to one of the players and be like, hey, just call my style. It's not like this, right? We even tried this actually in ESL New York. Pimp was in the roster. I think it was ESL New York 2016 or 17.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember, but I remember Nitro was calling in that team. And I remember that I wrote on a piece of paper a lot of like the stuff that we should do in the game. Obviously, he didn't have to follow all of that, but it was kind of like a guide, you know, of like things that I think that could work to help me to call and stuff like that. And he actually used a little bit of that. And the other was just mainly him, obviously, as an IGL. But, you know, after that event and after some time, I realized like that I would have to go under a period where I had to change my mentality a lot if I wanted to stay in the scene as a coach and stuff like that. And it took a toll on me. It took a long while for me to realize that I should change my approach as a coach. Yeah.
You brought it up there, but that's another thing I wanted to ask about was, this is actually, if people don't know, the first period where Nitro became the IGL of the team. Because in this squad, they tried a bunch of people, like Hiko did it for a while, and like they all took turns, basically. And then, so Nitro took over. But what people won't know is, they're going to think now, because he's still an IGL now, like, oh, it must have gone really well. Like, I've heard it wasn't that great. Like, I've heard basically, he sort of only agreed to do it, because it's like someone had to do it. And it was one of those things where it was more like, probably just do it for like a month or something, you know. And like, he wasn't the IGL he is now, though, I've heard. So like, back then, if people don't know, he was even like a fucking entry player. He wasn't even like the sort of player you necessarily pick as IGL. Like, what was the initial period of him being the IGL like? It seems like he must have had a lot to learn, right?
Yeah, he had a lot to learn. But I think the thing with Nitro is that he's a super chill guy, very easy to talk with. And I think he had not only the trust from all the players, but he got along very well with everyone. And still, even today, like, you rarely see Nitro having any personality issues or anything like that. You basically don't hear anything bad about the guy. Like, he's just very nice to be around, like, very good player to have in a team who's basically sacrificing himself and doing whatever the team needs. And I think this mentality did help me a lot. I think, you know, it's pretty unfair if I would say that I helped Nitro to become a good IGL or something like that. I probably gave him a little bit of a, like, I probably did give him a little bit of confidence to be at the beginning when he started, and guided him a little bit of like how I think he should be calling. But I think you gotta give proper to Zeus, right? Who used to coach him, like probably helped him a lot to develop as an IGL. But you know, it didn't surprise me that Nitro actually did very well throughout the years as an IGL, mainly because of his personality. Because as we talked about in the previously, like Nitro was just really good in terms of like managing personalities and making sure that everyone felt comfortable in the team, and he wasn't harsh or anything like that. So I'm pretty sure that Nitro as an IGL was always that type of IGL who would listen to his players, who would always listen to Elish, try to make Elish feel comfortable, which was a huge part back in the days in Liquid and even today, right? I'm assuming so. I think Nitro was just very good at like understanding each other differences and making sure they all feel comfortable in the game. And definitely Nitro is not the type of guy who's going to be like demanding stuff or trying to control everything and make everything his way and stuff like that. So I think, you know, he's one of those good examples for me as a guy that may not be like super, maybe he doesn't have like the knowledge of like Kerrigan and Glaive and those type of IGLs, but he's probably really good at like managing the personalities in the team, and like understanding like where to put all the pieces and making sure that they have a system that functions to some extent. Yeah, I think that's it.
This was the era of Team Liquid for me when Elige really started to break out individually. In fact, I've even told the story before, just because knowing some of the behind the scenes stuff. Like, as you say, because the premise was basically like, Hiko secretly just wanted Sample to stay the whole time. So as you say, he thought like, if we make the major file off, we win the major, like I can convince Steve from Team Liquid to just like, just pay whatever it costs. Like if it's $1 million, whatever, it's worth it. Like, look, this guy's going to win the world championship. So like his whole thing was like, we've got to get Sample, because he understood like, this guy's fucking insane. But I've heard like a bunch of the others, others were either just like in the middle. So they were like, look, I don't really want him, but if it happens, it happens. But I've heard Elise really was just like, nah, fuck it. I'm out. I'm not on that move. And I even heard he was almost just, I've heard basically whether this actually happened or not, the gist of it sounds too good. If this is a movie, this would definitely happen. I've heard there was even a convo where it was like, he caught or something like that, said to Elise, like, well, who's going to carry if Simple's not here? And then Elise was just like, me. And it's like, he actually kind of did though. I'll give him props. Like, he became really good after this, dude. Like, who was Elise as a player? Because obviously now again, people are going to know he flourished into a really great player. But back then, there was a bunch of names that could have been good in America. No one, he wasn't like the surefire one everyone was picking back then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember that conversation specifically, but I do remember us having dinner after Cologne. And I think like we're all, Simple was not with us. I think it was actually the day of the final or the day after or something like that. We're having lunch or dinner. I don't remember exactly, but I remember we're all sitting at the table and we're talking about like, hey, we just made a major finals. Like, should we try to keep Simple? And I remember that Elish wasn't like, no, like if you guys keep Simple, I'm out or something like that. But Elish was like, ah, guys, like, come on. Like, I don't want this environment. Like, I don't want to be a part of an environment where I'm doing a lot of the things while the guy is not, doesn't want to be a part of this or doesn't want to be a part of the team environment and stuff. Like, that would make me very unhappy, you know? And once we heard that, we kind of, like, at least I understood that, like, Elish was so good, right? Even at the major, I think Elish was putting up good numbers and stuff. And Elish was super important for the team back in the days as well because of his role, because of the amount of potential he had. And I'm going to touch on Elish a little soon. But, you know, it was hard for us to pick between Simple and Elish because we needed both of them. And Elish was a much more like, we could trust Elish way more than we could trust Simple, mainly because Simple showed us that he didn't want to be a part of it. He wanted to join Navi. Like, even during the major, I remember a lot of the days, Simple was basically already hanging out with the Navi guys, like having a beer and talking to them and stuff like that. Probably already, you know, slightly negotiated his way into Navi. So we could tell during the major that Simple was already, you know, focused on something else. So it wasn't like a really hard decision for us to stick with Elish. But we could have tried to at least talk to Simple and make sure, like, hey, mate, like, we made the major finals. Maybe you can change a little bit of your approach. Like, the thing I regret, and I think the thing Hiko regrets a little bit, and maybe even Elish, if you talk to him nowadays, like, I don't know if he regrets it or not, but we should have at least tried to talk to Simple and understand if there was a way that he could change a little bit and try to find a middle ground for him to be able to stay with us. If he would have stayed or not, probably not, because he would love to join Navi. I understand that. But I mean, I do regret not even trying. But the thing with Elish, like, when I started coaching Elish, right, Elish, still up until today, was one of the players that when I sat down with him to talk about Counter-Strike, he's just insanely smart about everything. Like, he does put a lot of hours into the game, dedicates a lot to the game, and he is one of the players that when I sat down with him to talk about Counter-Strike and my way of thinking about Counter-Strike, the way we should play or whatever, he was one of the guys challenging me and questioning my stuff in a very smart way, in a way that I would be like, oh, I actually didn't think about it that way. You're actually right. And he was always able to do that with pretty much anyone in the team. So I don't know exactly why. I think Elish also, like, I think he does have a background competing in different games. I think StarCraft or something like that. And he always had, like, he always been, like, very good in all those games. Like, pretty much everything he touches, he's always a very talented player, always good. And it wasn't different with CS. And basically, like, I think Elish is just a very good player to have in a team because of what he's capable to do on the server. Individually speaking, very talented. But I think, you know, the biggest challenge with Elish back in the days, at least, was, again, personality-wise a little bit. You know, I remember us having a little bit of issues with Elish when it comes to, like, putting him out of his comfortable zone, because he was a guy that really wanted to be in his comfortable zone because to play the way he wanted and stuff. And I remember us struggling a little bit when, you know, I even remember a case on Dust 2 where, I don't know, like, he used to play a rotation at city side on Dust 2. And then suddenly we found ourselves in a situation where we needed someone to play long. And then everybody was just like, well, we have nobody wants to play long. Elish, do you want to give it a try or something like that? And then Elish wasn't ever a player who's like, no, I don't want to do it. He was more like, yeah, sure, I'm going to give it a try. But, like, you know, he was doing that But at the same time, you could tell he was super tilted. So like after a couple of practices, like you could just tell he's mentally out of it, super tilted, hard to deal with. And then like he would shut down and stop communicating and stuff like that. I think he's probably developed a lot in that sense throughout the years. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in Liquid anymore. But, you know, the biggest challenge with Lelouch was a little bit of this, like, this ego he had. But it wasn't there was a reason behind it. Like, he's just so good, individually speaking. Like, he's just so smart that, yeah, I mean, nowadays I understand why he had a little bit of an ego. Because if he didn't, he wouldn't be the player as he is nowadays.
Yeah, this touches on something that in my content, people who followed it a long time will know this. I was actually one of the people who brought this story out, which was, I famously did it just to show people there's different types of personalities in the game. So famously, I said, when they had the team before with Simple, like anyone can see that Simple has problems because he's just very blunt. Like he'll just tell you straight, like the joke is he's one of those guys who doesn't have the filter. He'll just shout loud out of his mouth like, you're shit and you didn't do a good enough job and you should just do what I say. Whereas like everyone else will be like, whoa, you can't just say that to someone. Like, but Simple will. He'll just say it like, he's just a very straightforward person like that. So the thing is, if someone like that's getting angry or upset or stubborn or what doing, it's really obvious to everyone that there's a problem. But I always said, the thing about someone like Elise is way more subtle. Because as you said there, none of the things the person's saying makes it seem like there's any issue. Like he's like, yeah, I'll do it. Oh, okay, I'll give it a go. And as you say, it might just be like he's just gradually, like it's getting to him a little bit, but he doesn't say anything about it. And so I wanted to know this, because it feels like this must have been the other challenge for you and your team Liquid period was. You also had a culture clash. Like you're thinking, look, I can speak English, they speak English, we're going to understand each other. But the difference is, in a Brazilian team, I've no doubt all the fights and the drama, it's like it's just obvious, it's in front of your face. In this team, they were all super quiet, like introverted. Like the joke is in this squad, instead of someone saying like to your face, like, oh, I totally disagree, like I'm not going to do that, it's like they'll just be like, yeah, whatever. And then they sit down, and then my joke is like you just see like two of them, magically a Steam box opens up, and they're just typing each other, and you're like, what the fuck? Like, you're obviously just talking about me now, you know what I mean? Like, in that scenario, that must be weird, like, that's hard to deal with.
Yeah, that was really hard to deal with. I think that was one of the biggest challenges I had for sure. Because like, you know, going from the Brazilian culture, we're always like very straightforward with each other, very honest, transparent with each other. So we're able to sit down and just talk about the problems and figure out what needs to be done. And in Liquid, as you said it perfectly, like it was a completely different environment. Like people are very introspective. I think the only guy back in the day who was capable of like sharing his opinions and having a strong voice in the team was mainly Hiko. I think Hiko had a very strong personality back in the days about, you know, the way he felt comfortable and stuff like that. JDM as well. JDM, Josh was very good at like voicing his opinions in a good way. But the other three, like, you know, Simple, very outspeaking, but also didn't know the way he should say things. He was way too harsh sometimes. Same goes for Pimp, I would say. Pimp was also like very, you know, strong personality, like didn't know necessarily the best way on how to say things. Same goes for me. But Alicia Nitro, yeah, super chill guy, super introspective. Like they would basically like, it was hard. It was really hard to get that team to do like, you know, to sit down and talk about the problems we had in a good way. Like back in the days as well, like nowadays we see a lot of like psychologists helping the teams and stuff like that. And back in the days we had none of that. It was mainly me trying to figure out like the way we should approach things and together with the Liquid management and stuff. But I don't think that we had, like, to be honest, like I quite frankly, I think I can't even remember the amount of times we actually sat down as a team to actually talk about the problems we had as a six men, you know, sitting down together to figure out what's going on. Like, we rarely did it. Like, it was mainly like split it between groups or me asking the players to come to my room to talk individually, which I used to do a lot. But it was never like as a team thing because we could, there's always this thing about teams, especially in North America, I think, that it's just hard for them to open up and talk about their problems in front of each other. So it always had to be done in private, I would say. Like most of the time, it always had to be done in private and you had to basically figure out like a way to fix all the issues without, you know, putting them to talk to each other to maybe figure out by themselves and stuff like that. Like it was really hard, yeah.
Money doesn't grow on trees. And believe it or not, just watching a video for free with the odd ad doesn't really pay the bills. So thanks to the following people for kindly supporting my work and this particular content. And those people are, of course, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Animosity, Butt Pounder 420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion, my main man. You know what? There are plenty of perks to be found on my Patreon. Like, you can find out who upcoming guests are for my reflections, interviews and talk shows. You can ask me a question in my monthly AMA. Might get roasted if it's a bit spicy in how you phrase it. You can figure out which pieces of content I might want to do next. I often ask people which they think between certain ideas, offer suggestions. You can even take part in one of those long discussions with me about all kinds of esports, whatever's on your mind. So if any of those sound like something that takes your fancy, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrilluminati today via the Patreon link in the description below.